The mission is called SCOTUS Notes. The goal, to transcribe the conference notes of justices of the High Court. It's a window into the closed-door conferences, a collection of nearly 50,000 pages of the justices' handwritten conference notes on file at the Library of Congress. We're talking about this massive crowdsourcing project here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Timothy Johnson is Morse alumni, distinguished professor of political science and law at the University of Minnesota. He's a former co-editor of the Law and Society Review and co-author of several books about the High Court. He's lead researcher on SCOTUS Notes. Timothy, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Kate.
Well, 50,000 pages, that is a whole lot. How did this project come about?
That's a wonderful question, and you're right. It is a lot of paper, although luckily we are not using paper. All of these images are digitized, and so there's a good environmental savings there, I suppose, because 20 years ago we would have had to photocopy these pages if we had wanted to transcribe them. This project came about through years and years of thinking about analyzing the court's conference discussion. Scholars, both in the legal academy and in the political science academy and other disciplines in the social sciences, have studied almost every aspect of how the U.S. Supreme Court makes decisions. And the one part of that process that has really been left out is the court's conference. And that's for a couple of reasons. One is that this is, we sort of joke, beyond national, the NSA meetings that take place in Washington, D.C. The court's conference discussions are the most secretive meetings that take place. Nobody is in the conference room except for the nine justices. No clerks, no secretaries, no security, nobody except the nine. And so no one really knows what goes on in those rooms, and there's no official record of what goes on in that room. And so for decades, it was impossible to know what the justices talked about, unless one of them might talk in a memoir about a particular conference, and that almost never happened. It turns out that when several justices began to retire from the bench and started leaving their notes to either the Library of Congress or other archives placed at mostly law schools around the country, it turns out that a number of them actually kept personal notes during conference discussions and kept those notes in their archives. And so we really started seeing these as we delved into, for instance, Justice Harry Blackmun's archives that opened up 14 years ago in 2004. And so we said to ourselves, we'd really like to study this aspect of the court's decision-making process. The unfortunate part is that the justices' handwriting, for the most part, is similar to medical doctors. It's not very good. And so transcribing large portions of these notes is really time and therefore cost prohibitive.
So the justices provide those notes to such as the Library of Congress or, as you mentioned, a law school. Has there been a history of this, that many justices have done this, or is it a case-by-case instance here?
It really is a case-by-case instance. So, for instance, we do have notes going back to the Waite Court in the 1870s and 1880s, although those notes are not incredibly copious, and they really are more a record of the votes the justices took. It's really sort of post-New Deal that we begin to see the notes. And so Justice Douglas, when he left the court in 1975, his papers ended up at the Library of Congress. And then maybe most famously, and to the consternation of many on the High Court, when Justice Thurgood Marshall left the bench in 1991, he had his papers opened up almost immediately. And the justices were concerned, including Chief Justice Rehnquist at the time, because he thought that perhaps there might be things that would embarrass the other eight who were on the bench with Justice Marshall. And it turns out there's really nothing embarrassing in these files. It really is just a really good historical look into what the justices were thinking when they were making decisions on some very mundane cases, mostly mundane cases, but then some of the most salient, important cases in the history of United States law.
We're talking with Timothy Johnson right now about this project called SCOTUS Notes. It is a crowdsourcing project to transcribe the closed-door notes left by high court justices during their time on the bench. And he's lead researcher on SCOTUS Notes. You can join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. What do you wonder about SCOTUS Notes? If you could pick one Supreme Court justice or one case to delve into, which would you choose? What questions do you hope the project will answer? 800-642-1234. You can send an email to idea@wpr.org. Timothy, official Supreme Court opinions, these are public documents available to the public right now. What notes are you working on within SCOTUS Notes?
Sure. So we do not use any contemporaneous notes. So justices who are currently on the bench, they own those notes. And in fact, even the retired justices own their notes. And so it is up to them if or when, if ever, they would like to make those notes available to the public. So, for instance, Justice Hugo Black, who was another FDR appointee and left the bench in the early 1970s, on his deathbed, so sort of the myth of Hugo Black goes, he told his family, please just burn all my papers. And it wasn't because he thought that there was something that was damning in those papers. It was that he actually thought that the public and scholars would find them very boring, and he didn't want his family to deal with them. And so he really just got rid of all of them. And so the papers that we have, given that current justices will not allow the public or scholars to see their work product, if you will, we have papers that go from about 1939, a couple of years into Justice Douglas's tenure on the U.S. Supreme Court, to the end of Justice Harry Blackmun's tenure on the bench, which is in June of 1994. So just under a 60-year span of notes we have.
So, and you're working on transcribing Justice Blackmun right now, so pretty contemporary.
Very much so, right? Even though he has now been off the bench for 24 years, he sat for some of the most important cases of the 21st century, from Roe versus Wade to Texas versus Johnson, the infamous flag burning case. And so absolutely. And his notes include some justices who are still on the bench. I guess one, Justice Kennedy at this point, but up until a couple of years ago, Justice Scalia. In fact, I was just looking and transcribing some notes that Justice Blackmun took about things that Justice Scalia and Justice Kennedy said in the past couple of days.
Well, everyday people are lending a helping hand to you to preserve this history in a couple ways. Can you tell us about the first step volunteers complete for this SCOTUS Notes project?
Sure. So SCOTUSnotes.org is the website that anyone who would like to volunteer to transcribe would go to. And there's really two steps. As you said, the first one is we want all of the notes pages actually cut, if you would think about cutting them with a scissors, but we're cutting them electronically. And so when the justices go into conference, the court actually provided them with sheets of paper that were either cut into quadrants or sometimes cut into thirds, and they would have each justice's name in one of these sections, and that's where a justice like Justice Blackmun or Justice Powell or Justice Brennan would take the notes of about each of his colleagues. So the first workflow, as we call it, really is a boxing exercise where you use a drawing tool to simply draw a box around each one of those quadrants or thirds, and then we have a mathematical algorithm behind the scenes, which will then quite literally cut those sheets of paper into those sections. And the reason we do this is that the pictures are hard to read because of the handwriting, and sometimes the pictures are small. And by cutting up each of the sections, we can blow those sections up like you would blow up a picture and make it easier for a volunteer then to get to the second part of the process. And that is perhaps the more exciting, and that is actually reading and transcribing the notes.
Okay, so we're at the second stage, and so you've blown up the notes, and you can see them a little bit more. How does transcribing work?
So transcribing works, we actually do it on a line-by-line basis, if you will. So a volunteer will, again, use a drawing tool and draw a line under the first line of text in the picture, and then a pop-up box will come up and you can type in exactly what you think has been written. Now, the beauty of crowdsourcing, the beauty of the website that we're using, is that multiple volunteers see every single picture. So in the transcribing part of the process, we do not end, or what we call retire, a picture until it has been transcribed or seen by 10 volunteers. Again, we have an algorithm that then allows us to get probability distributions. I hate talking mathematics, but it gives us probabilities about what each word actually is, which will give us the best idea of what a word is, because it turns out, with the handwriting being so poor in some cases by the justices, and with some of them having their own shorthand or quirks and writing styles, that we want multiple eyes so that we can get a really good sense of what these words really are. And it'll allow us to have the most accurate picture of what is being said.
Timothy Johnson is with us. He's a distinguished professor of political science and law at the University of Minnesota. Getting your questions about SCOTUS Notes, 800-642-1234. What are you wondering about this citizen scientist initiative? If you could pick one Supreme Court justice or one case to delve into, what would it be? Call in, tweet us, WPR Mornings. Back in a moment. A crowdsourcing project led by researchers at the University of Minnesota and Michigan State is lifting the veil on the private weekly conferences of the high court justices over time. It's called SCOTUS Notes. We're learning what the project entails with its lead researcher here in the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Here are the stats that we know about SCOTUS Notes. The project launched on February 13th. In its first 6 hours, 308 volunteers had signed on and completed just under 2,800 classifications of the notes, which is that first step we were learning about before transcribing. University of Minnesota law professor Timothy Johnson is leading this effort to preserve private notes from past U.S. Supreme Court justices. He's a former co-editor of the Law and Society Review, co-author of several books on the High Court. You can join in on this SCOTUS Notes conversation at 800-642-1234. Perhaps you're considering signing up for the project. What do you want to know about the process? Do you have concerns about any part of this process to document these notes? Do you have misgivings about diving into the thoughts of justices during private deliberations? Call in 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Timothy, discerning the justices' chicken scratch, if you will, could probably be very difficult. So how does that part of the transcribing work?
So, that part of the transcription is done through very careful consideration of almost every single letter that is written. And sometimes it's quite easy to discern, although you can see a very clear pattern from the time a justice joins the bench until that justice leaves the bench, where you sort of see handwriting go downhill. And I think that that is something that all of us experience as we age, I suspect. In terms of this process, as we were talking about before the break, we really have each of the volunteers take one section of every page of notes. And so when you're transcribing, you only look at the notes about one of a justice's colleagues at a time, and you go line by line, transcribing every letter or every word that you can. And we know that there are times when words are simply indecipherable. And then in those instances, we ask the volunteers to simply put in a series of asterisks, and then hopefully another volunteer, because we do have up to 10 volunteers, look at every single one of these pictures. We hope that another volunteer might be able to figure out what that word is so we can have a clear idea.
But the more you work with a particular justice's handwriting, perhaps the more insights you gain as to what those words might be.
I think that's absolutely right. And that's what we have learned over the years. And so I spent a large portion of my career, and so did my co-investigator Professor Ryan Black at Michigan State. We spent a large part of our careers reading notes from Justices Blackmun and Justice Brennan and Justice Powell. Those are the three most prevalently used notes in other parts of the court's decision-making process. And we have come to learn over the years what particular letters look like, what particular words mean. And I'll give you an example. Justice Blackmun had his own penchant for shorthand, and he didn't use shorthand as you might have been taught in a school 30 or 40 years ago. It was simply something that was very personal to him. So he almost never wrote the word the. He would only write a small t. He almost never wrote the word b, b-e. He would only write the letter b. He didn't like to write out the words for whether or not he or his colleagues would affirm a lower court decision or reverse the lower court decision. Instead, he would write a plus for affirm or a minus for reverse. And so you do absolutely learn those sorts of quirks of a justice and each of the justices' particular handwriting quirks as you work with these notes more and more.
What kind of reception have you gotten on this from people who have signed up?
You know, I think people have been very excited about this because people are so interested in the U.S. Supreme Court. This is one of those things where it's not just folks who are in the academy or who write scholarly accounts of the court who, in very layperson's terms, geek out about the court, right? I do on a regular basis. But there is a massive population in this country who really are in love with the law and are very, very interested in the U.S. Supreme Court. And so it is opening up a branch of our government in a way that it's never been opened and that people want it to be opened because the court, not just its conference, but the vast majority of work that the justices do is not something that you can see on a regular basis. Whereas for Congress, you can turn on C-SPAN and see any sort of committee hearing you would like to see. The president, whomever he is at the time, is on TV almost daily. And so those two branches of government, we can really learn a lot about. It's the court that people really are interested in and really want to learn more about anytime they can.
So as you work on this heavy lift of transcribing these notes, what is the overall goal here for this project? What is it working toward?
Yeah, so we have two goals. And generally, you know, we think as academics that we really just want to have some sort of academic output. We've got some specific hypotheses we would like to test in terms of how these private small group discussions affect decision making. And so that is a clear goal because that's what we do as court scholars. On the other hand, we very much view this project as one that will open the court up to the public in a way, as I said, that it hasn't been opened before. And that's very important to us. So when we craft the book that we are in the midst of planning based on the SCOTUS notes data, we are going to write it in such a way that it will be accessible far beyond the academy because we really think it's important to open up the court.
How do you ensure the process has integrity, that you're getting the accuracy? Because these are, of course, citizen scientists.
That's right. That's the beauty of crowdsourcing. And so, and this is where, you know, I'll make a very clear plug for the folks that have helped us do this. And it is a group called Zooniverse, Z-O-O, UNIVERSE.org. Instead of universe, it's Zooniverse. And Zooniverse is a collaboration between the University of Minnesota, Oxford University in the UK, and the Adler Planetarium in Chicago. And they've been around for just over a decade. And it is the idea of using crowdsourcing to help scientists gather data. Zooniverse now has worldwide 1.7 million volunteers signed up on their website to help from projects that go from astronomy to biology to anthropology to history and now to the social sciences and law. And the data are actually very clear, and Zooniverse has published a good number of papers in various disciplines on this topic, on this question that you're asking, Kate. And what they have found is that when you do crowdsource, the crowd is really good at getting things very highly accurate, even in very difficult transcription processes. And so we have no doubt that we think the accuracy of these notes will be very high once they are fully transcribed.
And what you found, too, that if you had tried to just do this with you and your grad students, that it would take more than a lifetime to do?
I think so. And you know, that's maybe a little hyperbole, although those are my words, not your words, that taking a lifetime. It would have taken the vast majority of Ryan's and my career to do this if we wanted to make generalizable explanations about what happens at conference. And it really just would have been cost prohibitive in terms of the amount of time it takes to do any one case. Now, of course, there are some cases where Justices Brennan or Blackmun or Powell took very few notes about what their colleagues said. It was probably a very simple discussion. The case was easy to decide. But there are other cases. For instance, one that will be very important to the court this term as it deals with its gerrymandering cases, Baker versus Carr, which was the first time the court specifically talked about gerrymandering and made a decision about the idea of one person, one vote as well. And the notes in Baker versus Carr from the 1961 term are copious. There are lots of them. And so that particular case would take a long time for a particular transcriber to go through. And if we can have folks around the country and I believe around the world in some sense, coding these, it can get done so much more quickly. And then when you have the multiple coders to check for reliability, we can get pretty accurate pretty quickly.
We're learning about the SCOTUS Notes Project with lead researcher Timothy Johnson. He's a distinguished professor of political science and law at the University of Minnesota. Getting your questions, your insights, they're welcome at 800-642-1234. Perhaps you're already a volunteer for SCOTUS Notes. How has it been? What have you participated in? Have you participated in other citizen science or surveys? What do you enjoy about the process? Call in at 800-642-1234. Send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Timothy, Frank called from Onalaska. He couldn't stay with us, but he's curious whether the current justices are still primarily taking handwritten notes versus using laptops. What's the technology that justices are using these days?
That's an excellent question, and we don't know for sure. We do know that laptops and email are more and more the norm at the court. What we do know, though, is that the justices today, even through the youngest, right, Justice Kagan and Justice Gorsuch, they are still trained in law in the classical sense. And so it is our sense that in a meeting like this, unlike maybe in my classrooms here at the university, that most notes are still taken by hand by the justices. Now, we know that when the justices would send memos to one another, even through the 90s, that those memos were often typed and then sent between the chambers. Today, most of those memos are sent via email between the justices. So the real answer is that it's a mix between still taking handwritten notes and then using email and other electronic devices.
What algorithm have you developed to process all of this work as it goes on?
Sure. So the algorithm, and I will not talk a whole lot about this, the algorithm was created for us by a number of data scientists here at the University of Minnesota with the help of folks through the Zooniverse project. And the algorithm is simply a really pretty intense computer program, if you will, is another way to think about it, that really goes through and helps parse out in the first process, the one where the volunteers box the notes. It helps actually geocode on the each sheet of paper where each of the justices' notes are. And so when we have, in this case, five of the volunteers draw the boxes, we then have the algorithm will tell us what the best fit is for that particular quadrant or third of a sheet of paper. When it comes to transcription, the data scientists have gone through and created, again, a pretty intense algorithm that will tell us what is our best bet on what a particular word is. And that is not my part of the game. I'm very happy to say that we've got incredible data scientists behind the scenes who have created those algorithms for us. They've been tested very rigorously, and we know that they gave us really good output.
The project offers this opportunity to look into the high court during times the justices are considering really crucial cases. Can we explore a little bit Roe versus Wade? What did justices consider, and what was in those handwritten notes?
Sure, that's a really good question, and one of my favorite cases. I will tell you this, that the first time I went to the archives at the Library of Congress, which was 1995, to do some research for my then advisor in graduate school, the first thing I did was go to Justice Brennan's full file on Roe versus Wade, and it really was one of those really skin-tingling moments, if you will. I got goosebumps because you were holding a piece of history. These weren't photocopies. These were his actual notes. In terms of the conference notes themselves, it's pretty clear that the justices spent a whole lot of time discussing the idea of timing for a woman's right to choose abortion on demand. When does the woman have the right to make that choice, and when does the state get to step in and determine that the state has an interest in preserving life of an unborn, yet unborn child? And it turns out that they discussed whether or not that point would be quickening, that is the first time that a mother feels the fetus move in her body, whether it is the trimester scheme, which ended up being the law of the land after Roe versus Wade, or whether it would be when the fetus could survive outside of the womb on its own. And so they did spend a lot of time discussing that particular concept, and it turns out that that's ultimately what the case turned on. The idea that it is the trimester scheme, and Justice Blackmun lays it out very explicitly in the majority opinion, but that took up a decent amount of the court's discussion during conference.
What are some other cases that come to mind for you that have been real aha moments as you look at these notes?
Sure. So we have just recently been looking at Texas versus Johnson, as I said earlier, the infamous flag burning case. And that is such an interesting case because there were strange bedfellows in terms of who decided in what direction. So, for instance, the very liberal Justice William Brennan wrote the decision that said you absolutely have the freedom of speech right to be able to burn the flag if you would like to. And one of his colleagues, who you would not expect usually to sign one of his opinions, did, and that was Justice Antonin Scalia. And so you get one of the most ardent liberals on the court ever, Brennan, having one of the most ardent conservatives ever sign his opinion. But if you look at the conference notes, Justice Scalia actually says, according to Justice Blackmun's handwriting, this case makes me sick. On the other hand, there is a freedom of speech right to burn the flag. And so he doesn't like it. It makes him sick. And he still votes in the way that he thinks preserves freedom. Justice O'Connor was very similar. She didn't use the exact same language. What she said was, this is an unpleasant case. It's offensive to be burning the flag, but basically says, I probably should vote in favor of the freedom of speech in this case as well. And then finally, Justice Stevens, who came to be known as a very liberal justice on the bench, wrote a very, very harsh dissent in that case and said that there should absolutely be an exception to burning the American flag. And that is, yes, we have freedom of speech, but there are some things that we should protect despite that freedom. And you can see him talking about that in conference. In fact, he cites, according to Justice Blackmun, that is Justice Stevens cites, both Earl Warren, former Chief Justice Earl Warren, and very famous justice from the early 20th century, Oliver Wendell Holmes, who, according to Blackmun, Stevens suggested both of those two very liberal justices would have agreed with him that there should be an exception to flag burning. So you get a really rich view of the discussion the justices had and then how they ultimately voted in the case.
The SCOTUS Notes researchers tell us they're harnessing the power of citizen scientists or armchair scientists to transcribe a collection of nearly 50,000 pages of the U.S. Supreme Court justices' handwritten conference notes that are on file at the Library of Congress and some law schools around the country. We're learning about the project with SCOTUS Notes lead researcher Timothy Johnson. He's a distinguished professor of political science and law at the University of Minnesota. Getting your questions, your insights, they're welcome at 800-642-1234. Are you already a volunteer for SCOTUS Notes? Have you participated in other citizen science or surveys? What do you enjoy about this process? Call in 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. We'll pick up the conversation after this latest news right here on the Ideas Network. In the science world, the volunteers are called citizen scientists. In the social science world, same principles apply to engage citizen archivists. The research mission we're talking about this hour is called SCOTUS Notes. The project started about a month ago to transcribe the handwritten notes of the high court justices that are scribbled down in conference. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're learning about the project with the principal investigator, University of Minnesota political science and law professor Timothy Johnson. Getting your questions, your thoughts on this project at 800-642-1234. If you could pick one Supreme Court justice or one case to delve into, which one would you choose? What questions do you hope this project can answer? And do you have misgivings about diving into the thoughts of justices during their private deliberations? Are high court opinions enough, or should we know more about their thoughts? Call in 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Timothy, let's look more at the moral grounds of doing this type of work. Our country operates under this assumption of separation of powers. Executive, legislative, judicial branches are supposed to be checks and balances to the others. What have you already learned about the U.S. Supreme Court's relationship to the other branches of government?
Oh, that's an excellent question, Kate. What we have found and what we seem to be finding in a more systematic manner each time we look at the data as it comes to us in waves, is that the justices very much do, during their conference discussions, speak about Congress with one another, speak about the president with one another. And when they speak about the president, they're often speaking about the arguments made by the Solicitor General, who is the president's top attorney, who argues cases at the court for the administration. But I'll speak to Congress more generally, and that is the justices really are concerned. What did Congress mean when it wrote something particular in a statute? What will Congress think if we decide in a particular way versus decide in a different way or set policy at X instead of Y? What will Congress think and how will the members react? And so it really does show a concern for the separation of powers in a way that you might not expect for the justices, because even though Congress constitutionally has the power to overturn court decisions, it doesn't happen very often. It's quite difficult to do, even though it does only take a majority vote in both houses and then to have the law signed by the president. It is a difficult process because once the high court has spoken, it really is setting the law of the land, and it gets politically dicey for Congress to go against what the court does on a regular basis. But it shows that even though Congress doesn't act often, the justices do take that into account. And I think most scholars believe this is the case, that that's as it should be, that because the framers set up a system of separated powers, that we ought have each of the branches think about what the others are feeling and thinking as decisions are made. And so that's been one of the most interesting findings we've had in the conference notes so far.
Can you tell whether this has always been the case among justices going back to your start, you know, the start, 1939, or has the methods and vantage points of the high court's role changed over the terms?
You know, I would imagine that there is some change, although we have not noticed a whole lot of change so far. This is a pretty consistent phenomenon for the justices to engage in with one another. So you can think about it in terms of Brown versus the Board of Education in the mid-1950s, right? The justices were very concerned with how Southern Democrats, both within state legislatures, but within Congress specifically, would react to that decision. And so it is something that has been pretty clear throughout the entirety of the sample of cases that we have.
We're getting some great emails here. Nancy has a couple questions for you. First, why are the justices' notes considered to be their private property since they are or were federal employees?
That's an excellent question. This is actually something that goes back to the justices being part of the legal system and the idea that lawyers in your audience will know about, and that is work product. That the work product of the justices, when they are writing an opinion or working on a case, are simply theirs to keep. The products that are from the court, that is the court's opinions, are in some sense, quote unquote, the property, if you will, of the court or of the federal government, although I've never thought about it in those terms. But when notes are taken by justices, it would be just as if you were taking notes in a classroom, right? So my students take notes here at the University of Minnesota. The university does not own those notes. If I'm having a discussion with my colleagues, even if it's about how we're going to decide a case, those notes are mine. And so the norm over the decades and decades that justices, well, and two centuries that the justices have been taking notes, the norm of behavior has just come to be one of accepting that those notes are the personal property of the justices.
Another question here, will the notes become available to the general public eventually in a compiled form like a book?
So I don't know that we will do it as, I don't know that we'll do the notes as a book, but what we do know for sure that on scotusnotes.org, we will ultimately have all of the notes that are transcribed up online with transcriptions next to them. And so you'll be able to see the physical notes and you'll be able to see what the transcription is of those notes. So yes, the absolute plan and the absolute end of this project is not only us writing a book about the notes, but having the notes available so that the public can see them anytime they'd like to.
And that electronic data coming out of these transcriptions also enters this phase where you've got some big data things that you can do with it. Will you be able to crunch the data, for example, and tell, for instance, how many times certain keywords or phrases come up in their notes?
Absolutely. We can do that. And we do that already. So the other line of research in which Ryan and I engage is analyzing the court's oral arguments. And so we do a lot of that sort of data crunching with the transcripts of oral argument. And so we'll be able to do that here in terms of what words they discuss. The one thing that we don't think we'll be able to do is analyze sort of the linguistic nature of those words, because it is not a transcript of what is being said. It is just notes taken through the filter of another justice's mind. We won't be able to get into, was someone being sarcastic? Were they yelling at their colleagues? Were they upset or were they laughing when they said something? We can do that when we analyze full transcripts of what everybody says at oral argument. We won't be able to do that here. But yes, we will absolutely be able to crunch numbers in terms of what is being said, how often, and by whom.
We have an email from Jeffrey, who teaches at the University of Wisconsin River Falls. He's interested in volunteering for the project and says he has some former students who might be as well. Could you let us know how to volunteer? Jeffrey's email, you know, could be a jumping off point as to what is the next step?
Absolutely. So the way that volunteering works is you would simply go to SCOTUS, S-C-O-T-U-S, Notes, N-O-T-E-S, and it's all one word, scotusnotes.org. And all you need to do is sign up for an account. We don't ask for any information other than a username, and a password so that you can get in to the system. And in fact, if you would like to do it anonymously, you don't even need to sign up for an account. It just helps us track who we might end up deeming expert transcribers, folks who have done hundreds, who have really high scores on accuracy. But beyond that, you don't probably even need to sign up. You just need to go to scotusnotes.org and hit begin, and it will bring you right into the transcription process. It is very easy to begin being a volunteer. And so we would really appreciate anyone from River Falls, any alumni, any students, anyone from the UW system and beyond to your entire listening audience to get in and volunteer if they're interested in the court.
And people who do this work, this transcribing, have a direct line to researchers. What is unique about your relationship to these citizen archivists who volunteer to tackle these private notes?
So I'll have to say, Kate, I think that this might be my favorite part of this project, right? Because, you know, I talk to my friends both, you know, here in Minnesota as well as back home. I'm actually a native Wisconsinite. And, you know, oftentimes there's a disconnect. Oh, you're a professor. You do things up in the ivory tower and you don't talk to folks who just want to read about the court but don't want to think about it in a highly academic way. And what's great about the SCOTUS Notes project through the Zooniverse website is we have a feature. It is very simply called Talk. And you can click a button that says Talk and write us a note. And it is, in some sense, a text, if you will. It's sort of in between a text and an email. And Ryan and I will both get an email instantly when you write the note and hit submit. And it will tell us that somebody would like to talk to us or has a question. And we've both been very good about trying to answer these questions as quickly as possible. And so then we'll jump onto the Talk platform and we'll write back and have a conversation with one of the volunteers. Oh, I didn't understand this, or here's an interesting note that I found, or could you help me with this particular word? And so we have a back and forth. And I, as I said, this is probably my favorite part of this entire process, because I love talking to people who have a passion for the court in the same way that Ryan and I do. And engaging with those citizen scientists is engaging in a way that really does bring out the teacher in me and just makes me smile every day that I get to interact with the volunteers.
How long do you anticipate this project is going to take?
So I really do think that at this point, we probably can be done before midsummer. That is how quickly things have been done already. We've already gotten through over 11,000 of the subjects.
Wow.
And that is only the subjects for Justices Blackmun and Brennan. And in the coming 2 weeks or so, we will be putting up subjects for the early part of former Chief Justice Rehnquist's tenure on the bench. And we will begin putting up all of the conference notes from Justice Powell, who sat on the bench from 1971 until 1986, that 15-year period. And so there will be another probably 10,000 or more subjects brand new to the project being put up in the next week and a half to 2 weeks.
Well, absolutely fascinating. Timothy, thank you so much for joining us.
Kate, I really appreciate the time. Thank you for wonderful questions and for wonderful questions from your audience.
Timothy Johnson is a lead researcher in SCOTUS Notes. It's a citizen research project to preserve private notes from past U.S. Supreme Court justices. Timothy Johnson is a Morse alumni distinguished professor of political science and law at the University of Minnesota. He is a former co-editor of the Law and Society Review, co-author on several books about the high court. This hour of the morning show was produced by Keely Boltina. Michael Deringer provided technical direction. Michelle Johnson is executive producer. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This conversation on SCOTUS Notes is on the Ideas Network.